is that you have different organisms which interact, for example, food webs, and finally come up with a hierarchy of biological networks, starting from molecular biological networks on the bottom, a space, going up to really ecological networks. So biological networks are therefore quite important for the analysis of biological systems. Unfortunately, it's not that you just look at the network, but these networks are also embedded. They are embedded in space and time. Space, for example, shown here, we may have very short times where something happens in such a network, such as a reaction. The networks may differ in different developmental stages of an organism, and also networks may change between the different species in evolutionary times. But also shown here on this axis, space, so networks differ between different compartments in a cell, between different tissues, organs, and so on. So these networks are therefore embedded in space and time, and this is both, it's the dynamic of the network, so for example, the changes in metabolic rates in a metabolic network, but it can also affect the structure of the network. So you're not looking at one network which is fixed over the time of the lifetime of an organism, but also the structure, the connections between the different elements in a network may change depending on the embedding in space and time. Just to give you a few examples, here, for example, shown metabolic networks in different compartments. Here, for example, shown different metabolic networks from different organisms, how they change in evolutionary times. Or here is embedding in an organ different tissues in a barley seed, where you again have different networks. This all together, the networks in their embedding in space and time, the additional data which comes from experiments, it's often related to three different terms in bioinformatics. One is it's integrative bioinformatics because you try to integrate different data, different building blocks in such a system. The second one is systems biology because you try to understand the biological system by understanding the building blocks and the interactions. And more from computer science is what is also the title of this lecture, is network analysis, because you try to apply or develop methods, algorithms in computer science to analyze such networks. This brings us to basically three main research areas, more from computer science or bioinformatics point of view, to deal with such networks. Representation, so you have to represent these networks. That means you have to develop data structures for such networks. You have to think about databases and information systems, for example, to store metabolic networks, gene regulatory networks, and so on. You have to think about data integration. An analysis part, where you have to develop algorithms to analyze such networks. You may do simulation, for example, simulation of metabolic processes. It even goes into theoretical computer science, and of course, because experimental data is also involved, lots of statistics and machine learning. And finally, after you analyze this, you will also somehow present it to the user, so you have to think of good visualizations for such complex structures. So you have to think about visualization, computer graphics, and human-computer interaction is also involved in this area. What I'm going to do in this lecture, mainly focusing on simply showing you some algorithms or algorithmic solutions, how to analyze such networks. But as you can see, there are many different areas here involved in network analysis, and we will have the lecture of Ralf Hofestetz afterwards, so we'll see then probably more about simulation, Petri nets, and so on. As I mentioned, there are many different biological networks. Here just some well-known ones, starting from metabolic pathways, protein interaction networks, so more the molecular level, and going down to hormonal networks, food webs, evolutionary networks, and so on. And because we are now in a state where we get more and more data, it's also that these networks are getting more and more complex. So, for example, we have now large data about protein interactions, which can be represented as protein interaction networks, is shown here. We have large data about metabolic networks, and so on. So, to analyze such networks, you usually can't do it manually anymore, if you have thousands of elements and thousands of connections, but you need some computational methods. And there are several methods which focus on the structural analysis of the network. And these methods I'm presenting here are mainly from this class of network analysis methods, where you focus on the structure of the network and try to derive information from the structure of the network. To show you three examples is a motivation. This is the first one. One of these methods is called centrality analysis. Centrality analysis tries to rank the elements of a network, for example, the nodes here. Nodes are shown as these dots, red, green, or yellow. The connections between the nodes, in this case, it is protein interaction. So the nodes represent protein. The connections between the nodes represent protein interaction. The connection represents the interaction, and what you try to do is find a method that you rank the different nodes such that nodes which are more important are higher in the ranking. And this has been done for, as you can see here in the beginning of this century, for protein interaction in yeast. Young and his colleagues did knockout experiments. So they knocked out the genes which are responsible for the different proteins and checked then... What's happening with this? Checked then how this affects the growth of the organism of the yeast. And it's marked here. So proteins which are red mean if you remove them... then the yeast cell will die. The green ones are without any effect if you remove them, and the orange ones are somehow in between, so the organism grows slower than in the usual case. And the question was here, because these knockout experiments are quite expensive, I would like to come up with a method where you just look at the interactions and the network, and then get an idea which are the probably more interesting proteins. And what they found is that actually if you look at the neighborhood of each protein and look, for example, this one, take this one here, has a large number of neighbors where it has interactions, whereas, for example, this one here has only one interaction partner, or this one here. And look at the proteins which have many interactions, then you can show that these proteins are statistically significant more in the class of the red ones, of the level ones, than the other ones. And such a analysis, it's basically from graph theory, it's degree centrality. So it's a centrality measure where you rank the different nodes depending on the numbers of neighbors they have, and then can say that probably in the top of this ranking, the ones are more important because they are more level than in the bottom of the ranking. To show you a second example, network alignment and comparison, what you try to do here is, it is known that, for example, metabolic networks, but also gene regulatory and other networks, differ between different organisms, and you try to learn new things about one organism by comparing, for example, this organism to other ones. Here is a simple example shown, a very small metabolic pathway on the three reactions from green or plants. These are unicellular organisms, and these are animals. And as you can see, there are some differences, for example, here for this reaction in animals, there is an additional step. And the task here is you have to align the different networks. Alignment means that you have to find which partners are belonging, which are the same partners here. And then you have, of course, to compare them, define distance measures between them. And this is usually used to, for example, develop species-specific drugs. You can think of if you have a step in the reaction chain which occurs in bacteria and in a pathogen but doesn't occur in human, then this is an interesting target for a new drug. It's also known to, also used, for example, to get new information about one metabolic pathway where you have missing reactions from knowledge in other species or other organisms, so you can derive information. And of course, also you can derive phylogenetic trees from differences in networks and then try to get better ideas about the evolutionary relationships between species. So this is another network, structural network analysis method. And the third example I would like to show you here is the analysis of experimental data in the network context. Here just is an example. This is metabolomics data. You see here different metabolites shown here over measured over several days. Anyway, measured over several days, you have different replicates. And actually, this table is much wider. It's only shown here for the first five metabolites. And what you usually do if you measure this is you make some plots. So you plot the different metabolites. Shown here on this axis are the days over 20 days, and this is the amount of the metabolite. And then you see some metabolites may be low in the beginning and go up. Other ones are maybe high in the beginning and decrease over time. And then you may even use clustering to maybe group them. However, to get a better understanding of what's going on, it is very useful to take this information and put it in the biological context, and the biological context is given by metabolic networks in this case. So what you usually try to do is then you really integrate the different metabolites into the network as shown here, then may have additional clustering here, this clustered in three groups. For example, the blue ones are the metabolites which are high in the beginning and low at the end. The red ones are which are low in the beginning and high at the ends, and the yellow ones are somehow in between. And you can cluster this, and then you can find information which is also known from, for example, transcriptomics data, that the data which is shown here, which is from seed development in barley over 20 days, actually falls into two classes. Seed development in the first days, the seed need lots of amino acids, which are high in the beginning because the seed has to grow, and in the later stage, the seed needs lots of energy and produces starch, so the sugars here are high, to produce starch within the seed, and then there is an intermediate phase in between. So this is a third example as an introduction to this topic. And now I would like to come to some foundations and then to the applications. First, the topic is network analysis. Networks are very close related to graphs, and network is a term which is used in biology usually as an informal description for a set of elements, building blocks we had before, and interconnections or interactions between these elements. And usually in networks you also have some data attached to these elements. Whereas, to describe it from a mathematical point of view, usually the term graph is used. A graph is a formal description. It is a mathematical object which consists of vertices and edges, and these vertices represent the elements and the connections. And therefore, I will use graphs in the future because it's the more formal way to describe it. So as I mentioned, a graph consists of a set of vertices, usually denoted by V, a set of edges. The set of edges is a subset of the vertices. N is the number of vertices. M is the number of edges. And in the next two, three slides, I have to introduce a bit of graph theory, which we will need for network analysis later. So first of all, here is a representation of a graph. So the vertices are usually represented as circles or dots, and the edges as connections, as lines here in between. So you have the neighborhood of a vertex. A neighborhood of a vertex is all the other vertices which are connected to them. So, for example, the neighborhood of this vertex here is A and E. You need a representation for graphs. A typical representation is the representation is adjacency matrix. This is a matrix here. here are the different vertices here again, and you have a 1 if there's an edge between vertex A and vertex B, and a 0 if there's no edge. So it is an n times n matrix where the element is 1 if there's an edge, and if 0 is there's no edge. We need a degree of a vertex. The degree of the vertex is the number of its incident edges or of the number of its neighbors. So for example here, the degree of the vertex A is 2 because it has these two neighbors here. We need what is a walk in a graph. A walk is a sequence of edges. It's simply a way, for example, starting... That's not working anymore. So it's a sequence where you start at a vertex and then follow some edges. You can even go back or go several times till you end at another vertex. The length of such a walk is simply the number of edges. However, you're not always interested in any arbitrary way, so therefore we have so-called paths. Paths are walks where you use each edge only once. So for example, path from A to D would be starting at A, going here, here, and D, ending at D. And of course, between two vertices, there are always quite a number of different paths possible, and we are often interested in the shortest path. This is the path with the minimal length between two vertices. For example, again, if we want to go from A to D, the shortest path would be along this edge, and this edge. So there are some examples there, and you can look at them also later again. What we also need is the distance between two vertices. Distance is the length of the shortest path. We just hit the shortest path. We need what is a connected graph. A connected graph is a graph where between every pair of two vertices there exists a walk, there is a connection between them. Not a direct, but there exists some path or walk between them. Then for centralities, we later need also the notion of random walks. A random walk is you start at a given vertex, for example A here, and then you want to reach another vertex, for example D, and you always decide randomly if you take either this or this edge to come to the next node, and or from here you have two edges again, randomly choose this or this till you finally end up at the target vertex. And the final thing we need is the notion of a subgraph. This here is a complete graph, and we can define subgraphs of this graph. And a subgraph is a graph where the vertex set of the subgraph, here denoted as V prime, is a subset of the vertex set of the complete graph. So for example, for this graph, we could choose this vertex, and this vertex as subgraph. And the edge set of this graph is a subset of the original edge set restricted to the vertex set of the subgraph. So for example, we could choose here the edge from A to B and from B to E. Actually, if you would choose here, would want to have all the edges which occur in the complete graph, also in the subgraph between these vertices, then it would be called an induced subgraph. But here we only need the notion of a subgraph. And again, there are some examples for these definitions. So for example, the distance between A and C is 2. There's a random walk between A and C, and there's also a subgraph I just showed you for this given graph. If you talk about graphs, then there are many different types of graphs. What we have defined so far are undirected graphs, where it doesn't make a difference if you have an edge from A to B or B to A. But you can also have directed graphs where the edge has a direction between two vertices. You can also then define mixed graphs where you have both undirected and directed edges in a graph, and so on. So you can also have labels, means some names or tags at the vertices or edges. You can have multi-graphs where you have, for example, not only one edge between two vertices, but you can have multiple edges. So these are different graphs we don't want to consider in detail here, just that you get an idea that there are much more possibilities for defining different graphs than what I have shown you in the definitions. What is quite commonly used in biological networks are hypergraphs and especially then bipartite graphs. So a hypergraph is a graph where you have a set of vertices and a set of so-called hyperedges. And each hyperedge is a non-empty subset of the node set. So to show here, for example, is a metabolic reaction with some vertices. And the edge in between, it doesn't work anymore. The edge in between is a so-called hyperedge because it not only connects two vertices, as we have seen in the definitions of graphs before, but it now connects actually five different edges. And as hypergraphs are not so commonly used in graph theory, they are often modeled as so-called bipartite graphs. Bipartite graph is a graph where you have an edge set, and vertex set, which can be partitioned into two disjoint non-empty sets, here called V1 and V2, such that if you take any edge, then always this edge has exactly one end vertex in one of these vertex sets, say V1, and another one in V2. And I mentioned that this is often used to represent hypergraphs, and this is, for example, such a representation where you say the hyperedge is represented as one vertex from the vertex set V2, here shown in red, and the other original vertices belong now to the other vertex set V1, here shown in blue, and you then have additional edges which represent the original hyperedge and connect the original vertices to this vertex which represent the hyperedge. Thanks. Okay. So, I mentioned before all these other different types of graphs we want to use, or we don't need here. Hypergraphs are, and especially bipartite graphs, are quite often used, and again, in the next lecture from Ralph, if you think of PetriNets, they are usually represented as bipartite graphs. It's a common representation, for example, for metabolic pathways. One final slide for the foundations, graph theory, and so on. You also have to, you can, of course, have the graph represented as a data structure in the computer. For example, is this adjacency matrix I showed you before. But, of course, you want usually also to present the structure to a user, for example, of a tool. And to do so, you have to visualize the graph and graph visualization. So you have a graphical representation of the graph. And this is usually done by, in the simplest case, you represent each vertex as a dot or a circle, and each edge, here in this case, for example, a directed edge is an example, is a connection, which can be straight line or can have bends here. And if you do so, then you have to give positions to the vertices and also some routing to the edges. And this is called the layout of the graph. And there's not only one layout, but of course there are infinitely many layouts. And here are only shown three typical ones, so-called force-directed or hierarchical, where you start and try to place them from top to bottom, or here, such a kind of a grid layout. So, are there questions to the foundations?
Пожалуйста, если вопросы есть, задавайте. На самом деле, идея заключается в следующем, что вот такие сети, они, как бы, это новое представление в биологии. То есть, если раньше полагали, что вот один ген, одна функция, то, как правило, сейчас основная идея в том, что именно биологическая функция, она заключается вот в этих сетях. И поэтому вот такое математическое описание биологических объектов в виде сетей, оно является очень важным. То есть это вот некий новый уровень, на который вышла современная биология. Вот. Если кто-то чему-то непонятно, пожалуйста, можно по-русски спрашивать. Окей.
Okay, so, in this case, I just now come to the topic of analyzing.
One question, please.
So this one here is the hyper edge, because one edge has more than two endpoints. So it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 endpoints here in this case. And this is just an example for a bipartite graph, which is often used to represent such a graph, then where you have two classes of, or two sets of nodes, and see, there's no connection between blue nodes. So every connection is between a red and a blue node, always. That's the... Oops. That's me. Okay, then I would like to continue.
So, is it possible to make a short break or not? Maybe we, I'm thinking that we should have a 45 minutes parts with short break.
Oh, okay.
Is it okay?
Well, I only yeah.
Maybe I ask you in 10 minutes to have a short break. Okay. Перерыв устроен на минут на 5 сейчас или нет?
Yeah, okay. I think that it would be better okay. to just do the lecture in one. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Название графа по-русски, да? Гиперграфы? Ну, все понятно, да? Давайте мы потом, может быть, перейдем, да, после. Окей.
Okay, then I would like to continue with network motifs. Motifs are small patterns. You can think of, for example, this small graph is a motive, which occur in a large target network, for example, a gene regulatory network. And what is shown here is there are three matches shown, for example, this pattern here occurs here, here, and here in this target network. So motif detection network is, and we will see then some examples, quite a number of applications. So we want to see how many such building blocks may occur in a network. You will maybe see how they cover the network. And just to mention, usually you consider the size of a motif, which is given by the number of edges, and the size of the target graph where you look for motifs is also given by the number of edges in the target graph. Motifs have been of interest seit 4 or 5 years now, and in the meantime, quite a lot of papers occurred where different biological networks are investigated in terms of motif occurrence, and typical ones are gene regulatory metabolic networks, but also neuronal networks, food webs, and so on. What is the reason why they are so interesting? As I said, there are small subgraphs or patterns of local interconnection which occur in a graph, and typical ones are the so-called single input motif here, multiple input motif or feed-forward loop. And if you are able to find these motifs, you may be able to identify modules in biological networks, for example, modules in gene regulatory networks which are responsible for specific parts. And this may help you in a better understanding of this. Here's an example of the function or why it's considered is some functional module. One of the best studied motifs is the so-called feed-forward loop motif. If I go back, this is this one here, where I have basically three vertices shown here as X, Y, and Z. They build a little subgraph, And the explanation which you find in chain regulatory networks for such motifs is that often if you have an input signal, shown here is a very short signal, you may have a functional block which makes sure that the output signal is only then active or turned on when the input signal is active for a longer time here. So what happens with such a regulatory functional module or motif that you have a gene X which upregulates gene Y, and also together with Y upregulates the gene Z. However, if the input signal here is only for a short time, then it may activate the X one, but it may not be enough to also activate Y in time. Therefore, there's no output signal. Here's the threshold for the output signal. And only if it's for long enough time, then you may get an output signal here. So this is one, but there are also for other motifs in the meantime potential explanations how they work in biological networks, especially gene regulatory networks, but also in protein interaction networks and some others. We are interested, therefore, in motif discovery in networks, and to deal with motifs in networks, you have to know that there are different ways to count the motifs. So motif frequency is simply the number of matches of a motif in a target graph. And as I mentioned, that's often so that also motifs of high frequency, which occur quite often, are good candidates for such functional properties, functional modules. However, there are different concepts to count motifs, and they are shown here. So the countage takes into account how we can reuse elements of the original graph, of the target graph. So we have here a target graph, a small motif as an example, and here then the matches. And if we say we allow that for different matches, vertices as well as edges can be reused, then we can find, for example, this match here, which matches this little one onto this. We can find this one here. You can find this one here, and actually there's one forgotten here. This one is also a match. So we would have four matches. However, if we restrict the reuse of elements and say that, for example, we are only allowed to reuse vertices for matches but not edges, then we only have two matches because we can use this edge and this edge for this match here, and then can only use this and this one for another match. There is no F3 because it doesn't make sense to restrict vertices and edges, not. But, of course, we can restrict the reuse of vertices and edges and say that if we find a match, then the next match is not allowed to use either the vertex or the edge, and then we only find, in this example here, one match. So, actually, to compute it, we can, here we have all matches, and here we can use algorithm for maximum independent set to compute subsets of this. What is the application, or why is it so interesting to have these different frequency concepts? So the first, of course, shows full coverage or full potential of network motifs. Well, often it is that, for example, in gene regulatory or signaling networks, one edge, which represents a signal, should be only used once for a match, and this is then covered by the frequency concept F2, where it shows the maximum number of instances of a particular motif which can be active at the same time because it doesn't reuse edges. And the frequency concept F3 is interesting because it allows you to cluster the network into separate motifs, and it has also some applications then for example, for motif preserving layouts. The problem with motif search, and this is something where people worked in other areas of computer science even 15, 20 years before, because motifs are not so specific to biological networks. You can also do motif analysis in, for example, UML diagrams or electronical networks. However, the term motif was termed for biological networks here. The problem is that there are many motifs and there are also many matches. And as you can see here, the number is growing exponentially. So if we consider motif size, and the motif size is defined as the number of edges of the motif, and we allow directed graphs, then we have, if we don't have reversible edges and no self-loops, self-loops are connections of one vertex to itself by an edge, then we may have three different motifs. But if we increase the size here to 4 or 5, then you see the number is growing. Just different motifs which could be found in a graph. For each of these motifs, then, we again have the problem, there are many different matches, so you can have a rough estimation that you have number of edges times number of edges in the motif is an estimation of how many different matches you may have for a motif in graphs. Therefore, the exact computation is quite demanding, and what I would like to do here is to show you some ideas how motif computation can be done and sped up. And one algorithm for this is comparably simple one is the problem of finding only the most frequent or number of the most frequent motifs. And this is an algorithm where you have a graph given as the target graph. You say you would like to find motifs of size, say size 5, and you give a specific frequency concept we have seen before, F1, F2, or F3, and the result is that it gives you back the motif of size T, which you define here, which occurs most often in this graph, and also, of course, how often it occurs. And the nice thing about this algorithm, it can be easily extended to, of course, you can have different frequency concepts, but you can also not only have the most frequent one, but, for example, define a frequency threshold, and all motifs which occur more often than this threshold are the result. And this is why this is especially interesting. You can do quite good parallel implementation of the search algorithm. I can't show you the complete algorithm here because this would be taking much too long, but I would like to show you the idea of the algorithm. So the idea is you start with motifs of size 1, which is 2 vertices and 1 edge in between, and you find all matches. And it's very easy because every edge in the graph is a match of this motif. And then you extend the motifs you found so far in every step till you reach the motif size, the target size T. You extend this motif by always one edge, and for doing this, you use the matches you already found. The idea is to avoid to search again every possible match, but simply reuse the matches you already found. You extend it, and you compute the occurrences of this motif, and you do this again and again till you have reached the target size. And to do so, you build a so-called motif tree here, where on the top, on the root of the tree, is the first motif you found. As I said, it's only of size 1. You have 1 edge and 2 vertices. And as you go down in the tree, you extend it by always 1 edge. And the interesting thing now is you assign for each motif you find exactly one parent, so really build a tree. Because it's not necessarily a tree. If you think, for example, this motif here, this structure here occurs here, and this structure here occurs here, so you could either assign it to this one or to this one. But there is then a special rule which make a canonical assignment so, such that you can build such a tree. And now, once or you're doing this during the algorithm, the nice thing is that you can now go along branches of the tree. You can compute different motif occurrences independently in the different branches here. This is one advantage because it leads to parallelization. And the second one is for two of the three frequency concepts, F2 and F3, there is a property which is quite useful that whenever you find a motif of size n, for example, you find 10 occurrences, all the motives which are derived from this can only occur the number of times this occurs or less. So the advantage of this is if you compute down here till the target size and find a motive which occurs quite often, and then compute other branches and find a motive which occurs not so often, then you can always stop the computation here and cut off all the remaining trees, the parts of the trees, and this also helps you in speeding up the computation. So this only is the rough idea of the algorithm. We will see the application later also in motive-based centralities, but this is an algorithm which solves quite a number of problems, or at least helps you in solving this. So for example, the problem of many different motives, the algorithm only considers motives which are supported by the target graph. It doesn't look at motives which are not supported, and therefore avoid counting or computing them. It builds and prunes this motive tree here, and allows also to do parallel computation. And the problem of many different motive matches, because you only extend existing matches by always one edge, you avoid to really recompute all the matches here, and you have two subproblems, maximum independent set for the two of the frequency concepts, and graph isomorphism for building this tree. Here you can use heuristics, and here a typical method to do or to help in graph isomorphism is canonical labeling. So the result of this is that even that motive computation has a very bad computational worst case. It's very expensive in worst case. It is in practice working well quite for networks of a few hundred to thousand nodes and motives of size 4, 5, or even 6. And you can use this then to compute specific analysis results for biological networks. I will show you the application of network motives in this section of network centralities, because there is a very useful centrality which is called network motive centrality and gives good results for different biological networks. But of course, network motives are also used to investigate especially gene regulatory protein interaction, but also other networks. So, network centralities. This is another way to do structural analysis of biological networks. The idea is, as I mentioned in the introductory example, to rank the vertices of the network based on the structure in a way that important vertices are ranked high or are high in this ranking. And this has quite a number of different applications ranging from finding potential genes or targets till the determination which patients, for example, should be vaccinated first if you think of not in this case then a biological but a socio-biological networks where you have people is nodes and interactions between these people is edges and the transmission of for example of a virus between persons is this edge. Network centralities, again just in the beginning the formal definition would be a bit more complicated, but the definition of this, so you can think of a network centrality simply as a function which maps the vertices onto numbers such that if you have two vertices, U and V, you would like to say that the vertex U is more important than the vertex V, and this is expressed that this function should give a larger result for U than for V. To give you an example, we have here again the graph we have seen in the beginning, this example graph, and we have the Cree centrality, which I also already mentioned, which simply counts the neighbors of a vertex. So for example, for vertex A, here we have B and E as neighbors. For vertex B, we have A and E as neighbors, so 2, 2, 2, 1, 3. And then from this, you compute an order by ordering using this as criteria for the order, and can say vertex E is the most important because it has the most connections here and sits in the middle, and vertex D here is the least important. So centralities rank vertices according to their importance somehow based on the network structure, and there exists more than 20 different centrality measures. The problem is, we will see this later, it's also the motivation why we then have a new centrality measure. Most of these measures come from different application areas. So centrality analysis has been done in social network analysis for more than 20 years. And it has been applied to different biological networks, especially these centrality measures here. I have for each one slide then. Has been applied, and we will see the results then also. Just to give you an idea why there are so many different centrality measures, if you consider these three nodes here, for example, this node, which is characterized by many neighbors, but it's somehow at the border of this complete network here, or this node, which only has two neighbors, but is somehow sitting in between and is a bridge between this part and this part, then you can easily imagine that at some point you would be interested in simply knowing who is the vertex which has most of the connections to other ones, or and say this is the most important. This is, for example, then using degree centrality. Or you would be more interested in the vertices which connects important parts of the network and are somehow the bottlenecks between these parts. And then you would have to use another one, for example, here the closeness centrality to compute such a ranking or such a ordering of the vertices. So let us start with these centralities which already have been used. The easiest one I already mentioned is degree centrality. It has been used for the example I showed in the introduction to find important proteins in protein interaction networks. And what I've done here is taking the example graph and just that you have the results, also show always for the different centrality measures the results of this centrality. The next one is eccentricity centrality. Eccentricity is the idea of you would like to find nodes or vertices and say nodes or vertices are more important if they are somehow more in the center of the network, in the sense that all the other nodes are not too far away. So it's defined, you've defined first the so-called eccentricity of a vertex, which is basically the maximum of the distance to all the other ones. So if you have a vertex which is, for example, here, then it has a quite high eccentricity because it may have vertices which are far away, whereas if you have one which sits in the middle, then you have quite a low eccentricity value because the maximum path to another, so you look to all the other vertices and look at the maximum, and this is not so far away. Therefore, the eccentricity centrality is defined as the reciprocal here, so that the ones which have here a high value get now a low value and vice versa. And you see it again here. So E and C, for example, are the most important vertices concerning eccentricity centrality, whereas A, B, and D are not so important. And this has been, for example, applied to metabolic networks to find or to define central metabolites in metabolism by not only the first paper was by Buchti and co-authors, but there are also some other papers which try to identify more important metabolites and also more important, for example, proteins in protein interaction network. A very similar one is closeness centrality. The only difference here is that you are not taking the maximum, but now you take the sum of the distances. And the effect is that it separates the nodes a bit more. You see it here now. The vertex E is clearly the most central one, and then the next value is here for vertex C, and then A, B, and at the end you have vertex D with the lowest closeness centrality value. Also, this has been used to define central metabolites, for example, metabolic networks. Completely different idea is the idea of betweenness. Betweenness is the question of, would like to ask, if I think of communication between the different vertices here along the edges, and I have communications between every pair along every possible path, and I take a node, for example, node or vertex E here out of this, how many of the different communications is this vertex able to observe? And is more different communications can be observed, is more important is this vertex. And you can see here that one of the betweenness centralities is the so-called random walk betweenness. Random walk means, we hit it in the foundations, that you look for random, you add a specific vertex and make a random decision if you take this or this path. And the random walk betweenness centrality is the number of times that you have a random walk from one vertex to the other one and ask the question how often this one can observe this walk. So as you can see here, again, you get values. Again, vertex E is, because it's in the middle, it has most chances to observe communications between any pair of vertices here. And again, you see then here, vertex C is the next position, and then A, B, and D. Also, this centrality has been applied to different biological networks. However, here, the results are quite questionable. And I think the main idea was just to introduce, for the authors of these papers, to introduce new ideas of centrality measurements coming from other application areas to investigate biological networks. A final centrality is, this is a complete different idea. If we go back to the Gries centrality, this is a local centrality which only looks in the direct neighborhood of a vertex to find out what the centrality value of the vertex is. If you look at closeness, eccentricity, or betweenness, this is a global centrality which takes into account everything of the graph, but can be easily computed because it only works on paths or distances. And this is a completely different concept again, where the centrality of a single vertex is determined by the values of the centralities of the neighboring vertex. That's a so-called feedback then, so you have a feedback centrality, and it is defined here that you have the centrality, the so-called one of these centralities, the eigenvector centrality of a vertex U, is defined as the centrality values of all the neighbors of U, and this is equivalent to, you can use the adjacency matrix to express this, and basically it comes back that you look at eigenvector computation, and in this case you use the eigenvector of the largest eigenvalue. Again, I don't want to go into too much detail here, but the important thing is that it's a complete different idea because you use feedback in the computation of, so the centrality value of one vertex depends on the centrality values of other vertices. Another example of such a centrality is actually the PageRank, which is used by Google. It's also a feedback centrality, but it's even more complicated than the eigenvector centrality. And again, you have here the values for this example. Just to show you that these different centralities also give really different results and therefore have different application areas. Here we have a larger example graph and again different centrality values. And just if you take this pair 8 and 9 out, which sits here and here, so for degree it is on top, here for eccentricity it is more in the middle, and we can visualize this even better. Again, this is here, for example, this pair 8, 9, you see in the ranking, this shows the ranking, this is the top place here, this is the last place, it goes up and down. And if you apply this to biological networks, for example here to protein interaction from humans, and restricted on a part of the network, on the largest component of this network, then we can see that if we compare the different centrality values, most of them differ quite much. So for example, degree and closeness really give very different results. This is a scatter plot which here shows you along this axis the ranking, for example, of degree, and here the ranking of eccentricity. And if you have something like this, then it means it's a very strong correlation. But so it's known that degree and random walk betweenness behave very similar at some point. And if you have something like this, then you really get very different results. Unfortunately, if you go further and investigate different biological networks of this, the result you get is always that that it may work for some specific networks quite well and give results you like, but most of the initial hope that simply application of centrality measures from social sciences, so where the centrality measures have been initially developed, to biological networks would help you in investigating them, weren't so fulfilled as initially hoped. And this is the motivation and also an interesting research area for you maybe, to really think of new centrality measures. As I mentioned, there are more than 20 from social sciences for different aspects of social networks, and I would like to show you one specifically adapted centrality measure for biological networks where it really then makes sense and gives good results to apply such centrality measurements to analyze biological networks. This works especially well for gene regulatory networks. Just briefly, gene regulatory networks, you have genes. Genes can be either transcription factors or target genes. The transcription factor regulate other genes, and this is usually expressed by you have the gene here. You have, and if it's a transcription factor, then it influences another gene, can be positive, can be negative, or can be not known if it's positive or negative. This is just an example here from E. coli. And one main question in gene regulatory networks is to find and identify global regulators. Global regulators have a number of different definitions ranging from can be the number of regulated genes. If it's especially high, then it's a global regulator, or it can be the size of the evolutionary family of this gene, if it's high, then maybe important, and so on. So there's a large number, and people started to identify manually in databases, for example, for E. coli, global regulators, depending on a list of such properties. However, such networks becoming larger and larger. For example, for E. coli, now it has more than 1,000 nodes and 2,500 interactions, and you really don't want to do it manually anymore. Therefore, you're interested, again, in computational methods. So, yeah, you would like to find some method to automatically identify global regulators. And an interesting observation is that we have seen it before by when we discussed network motifs, that these are relevant for gene regulatory networks. So the idea is to combine the centrality measures with network motifs and now to count how often occurs a motif in the network. So you're not only counting, for example, how many direct neighbors a vertex had, but you take a network here. You take a motif, for example, the feed-forward loop we have seen before, and then you check how often this vertex here, for example, occurs in motif matches. So this one occurs only in this one match here, so therefore only his one is centrality value. This one occurs in this match here, and in this match here, and in this match here, so it gets the highest centrality value, and so on. We can extend it by considering that motif usually, the vertices in a motif are somehow different. So for example, if we think again of this feed-forward loop motif, there are different roles attached or taken by these vertices. For example, this is more the regulator, whereas this one here is more the regulated genes. Or here again, these are regulators and these are regulated genes. So you can find groups of different, or you can partition the nodes into different groups depending on specific roles, and can use this again to refine the centrality. And this is shown here. If we consider this is the kind of a global regulator for this feedforward loop, this is an intermediate regulator, and this is the regulated gene. And now see how these vertices here in this example network, which centrality values they get. So for example, for the role A, which means for the regulator here, V2 and V1 are the most important ones, because they sit somehow on top of this regulatory cascade. Whereas if you consider the regulated genes, so role C, then you see V4, this node here, and this here. These are more important. So you can refine and adapt this kind of centrality to specific roles within a motive. And this can be easily extended because usually you don't have only one motive, but you have kind of motive classes. For example, for this single input motive, where you have one regulator which alone regulates a couple of different genes, you may have this motive, this. So you can simply extend it. You can also extend this to so-called motive classes and again have a specific kind of this centrality which helps you analyzing networks. And one example where this is quite helpful is so-called regulatory chains, where a regulator may not directly but also over several steps indirectly regulate other genes. This is another example. Again here, vertices with role A, in this case, are the regulators, and these ones here are the final regulated genes at the end of such a cascade. So as I mentioned, there are three different varieties of these motive-based centralities, either considering nothing else than the motive, considering roles, or even extended to different classes. And how does it work if we apply it to biological networks? And here, for example, is a gene regulatory network of E. coli with more than 1,000 genes and 2,500 regulatory events or regulation effects in between. And if we just use the feed-forward loop, because this is known as a functional module in regulatory networks, and apply it, then we get this ranking. Here are the gene names. Here are the centrality values. And what I've done is, there are some genes here in red. And Martinez and Collado-Vides, they identified in RegulNDB manually global regulators. I showed you the criteria for global regulators a few slides before. Using these criteria, they identified which are probably the most important in the global regulators in this gene regulatory network. And the interesting thing is that with this method, on the top 20 genes we have here, this, 20 out of 1,250, so this is less, it's 2%, we already find more than 50% of the global regulators using such a method. And we can even improve this if we consider now different roles. For example, if we say we are really interested in this role A here as regulator in such a motive, we see again this is now sorted depending on this role A. We see again the main CRP, FNR, and so on. And now find even 11 out of the 18. And of course, you can extend it also to motive classes. And here, for example, this chain class, and I show you this because it shows something very interesting too. Again, we find 8 out of the 18 global regulators, but what's interesting is that these two here, they have nearly no neighbors. So, for example, this one only has one neighbor, but they start a chain of quite a large number of different genes. At the end, each of them, this here regulates 300 or directly or indirectly regulates 325, this 322, different genes. They are not in the list of Collado-Vides, but if you go into literature, they are also described as global regulators for, one is, I think, for Yeah, oh God. So, but you can go in the literature and find that they are described as global regulators. So, and here it shows that such a method can be quite useful if you have a network where you don't have manual curation. To simply come up with a list of, say, the top 50 and only spend your work to annotate the top 50 because they are most likely then the targets you are interested because they are global regulators. So, this brings me to the last topic of this lecture. We have seen so far structural network analysis, and in this part I would like to extend it to adding experimental information to networks. So the idea is again, we would like to use networks, and networks consist of quite different elements such as genes, transcripts, proteins, and so on, and use it to get better ideas about experimentally measured values from transcriptomics, proteomics, metabolomics, and so on. What we have is we have to deal with different aspects. We have to, for example, deal with data integration. We have to deal with the creation or derivation of the different networks we are interested, data mapping and so on, and of course then also data analysis. And we all put it together in one tool. It's the Wanted tool. I showed the link at the end, so you can, it's freely available, you can use it, where you can put in experimental data. You can put in networks, you can have links to other tools, and within the tool you can combine these different types of data and apply specific analysis methods to hopefully get more information out of the data. I will briefly go through these different steps and then show you some applications of this. So to start with experimental data, you can attach, you get experimental data, of course, from different databases. We have some in-house databases, starting also to get external to it. You can simply use kind of structured files, Excel files or templates. We support templates where you have, here again, general information about the experiment, different lines or phenotypes or whatever. For example, day and night, you can. And here you then really have the measured values. And the measured values can be transcripts, can be protein levels, metabolite levels, and so on. Where you also have the possibility to have different replicates so that you can also do statistic. You can all put this into a file. Or the third way is, of course, you can also simply program a plugin to get your data in such a system. Besides the data from experiments, we need also networks. And again, there are different ways how networks can be included in such a system. So starting from databases, for example, we have a database for cropland metabolism. And also KEK data can be used. And actually, what we have with such a system that you can build your own KEK pathways, so you can, for example, say you're interested in the shortest paths between different metabolites, or you can combine KEK pathways. You have even a kind of a navigation system. So in KEK, you usually only get such one map, and we make these maps dynamically. So you have links in between. You get large overview map, which you can then separate. And these are different KEK submaps here extended to the different, and just enlarge this part here to give you an idea how this looks like. So you have then here the metabolites, you have enzymes here with the enzyme classification number, and you have connections to other pathways, and you could extend these pathways. So you have quite a number of different possibilities to get network data in. Of course, you can also use ontologies, because an ontology is also a network. It's just a, you can see it here as a directed network, which vertices and edges in between, and usually an ontology is not even a tree, so it's more like a directed acyclic graph. And finally, also you can use files such as graph exchange formats, GML, ParticNet, or systems biology, markup language, SPML, to get networks in such a tool. Here's another example of an ontology with some data attached. Once you have experimental data and networks, you have to integrate both, because often the experimental data use different identifiers. So what we support is therefore you can use different synonyms, information about associated genes, and so on, from sources such as KEC or XPASI database, sources such as if you use transcriptomics data, for example, FMatrix supports or gives you annotation for the spots in gene ontology, KEC ontology, and so on. And once you have done this step, that you integrated data and networks, and I don't want to go into detail because this is really a science for itself, and you can have more than one lecture about this. But once you have this in, you can do data analysis. And data analysis means that you now are able to, for example, see your experimental data, here, for example, transcriptomics data about enzymes, in the related pathway, or be able to have different charts which you can attach to nodes or edges within the pathway, where you have time series data, or bar charts, or just ratios between different conditions. The nice thing then is you can, doing this, not only consider one type of data, but for example, put metabolomics data as well as enzyme activity data into one diagram and infer information. For example, here it's interesting to see that for the different lines, this last line is very different in the metabolites, but doesn't have any change in the enzyme activity. And you can then use this, for example, to find maybe there's a detour here which gives another reaction which is upregulated or so on. Can do statistical analysis, look for example for correlations between here different amino acids which are highly positively correlated in these different lines. You can use clustering, and I showed the application of such a clustering mechanism in the introductory examples, where you can use, for example, self-organizing maps or other methods from clustering machine learning methods to get better insight into your data. And here just another example where transcriptomics data is then also automatically visualized, that, for example, the upregulated ones are above the related term and the downregulated ones are below it. And you can use it for quite a number of different applications. This one we discussed in the beginning. Here, for example, you can be interested in how much do I cover with my experimental method. In this case, we had proteomics data from partners who work also in Bali, and they were interested of how much of the metabolic pathways do I cover. And each of these rectangles here is an enzyme. So ideally, you would like to have every rectangle red, because the red ones are the ones which they can measure with the proteomics method so far. You see there are some still white, so it helps them to improve their methods to see where they need special emphasis for measurement methods. In this case here, just this is a picture of from the MetaCorp system, where you have metabolic pathways in different compartments. This is one compartment, another compartment, here's another one. We have transporters in between. Just to as a short explanation. We saw this, you can use it to integrate different data, in this case from potato. You can use the system actually also, it's independent from plants. So this is an example from collaboration with people who work on stem cells in mouse, where you can use it to explore up and down regulated genes in here, for example, MAP signaling pathway, and see which genes are, or what the effects of up and down regulations are, and if it also influences, for example, downstream genes. So there are many possibilities, and finally, you can also use such a tool, of course, to simply produce nice presentation of your data, of your results you achieved, and use it to publish it. So just a few comments about the system architecture of such a system. What we use is we have a system which is based on a toolkit called Gravisto, which we developed together with people from the University of Passau, which is consists of a base of different data structures and basic algorithms, and the possibility to have everything else is plug-in on top, so also some Gravisto plugins, but especially all the different methods, algorithms, and even different graphical user interfaces can be plugged in. The complete system is a model view controller concept, so you have an event manager which helps you in observing events from specific plugins and make sure that then the system reacts as you like also in other plugins. Just to give you a brief idea. So see that I'm just in time. So to sum up the lecture, what I've done is I hope I gave you a motivation why it is interesting to do network analysis and how biological networks or why they are important in terms of integrative bioinformatic systems biology. I showed you a few motivation examples. We discussed in the foundations, especially graph theory, because there's still the gap between networks and graphs. Networks is an informal term. Graphs is the formal definition. And then from a wide variety of different structural network analysis methods. It's not only motives and centralities, but you can also, for example, do clustering in networks. I showed you two applications, network motives, where the goal is to find small reoccurring patterns in networks, and network centralities, where I would like to rank network elements based mainly on the structure of the networks. And we finally have seen that it's also making sense to integrate different experimental data into the networks and to do analysis with this. I mentioned before that I give you all the web pages. So there are different tools, for example, for motive analysis. We have a tool for centrality analysis, which contains more than 20 different centrality measures. This is the tool I just showed at the end to integrate experimental data. Metacrop is just this information system or database for cropland-specific metabolism. And here is just another tool to explore KEK pathways in very different ways. And if you are interested in this topic, just 2 months ago published a book about analysis of biological networks. There are more of these structural analysis methods, for example, as I mentioned, clustering of networks, but also for the different topics I discussed today, they are in much more detail. You have the algorithms there, you have examples also from more biological examples. It's actually separated in 2 parts. One is more from the computer science with the methods from computer science, and the second part is then for the different biological networks with the applications of network analysis, so you can also look there. That's what I can tell you, and if you have questions, I'm happy to try to answer them.
Please, if you have questions, please ask Falk, because he will be going back tomorrow, yes, and you have only today, you may ask him question.
But I will be also around later, so you can
be also grab a little. Есть пожалуйста.
I have a bit of a general question, but I'm interested in how sensible are your methods of the calculations of centrality of vertices and for the structural organization to clustering, etc., to the errors, because your graphs are composed out of experimental data, mm-hmm. which is A, incomplete, and B, might be wrong. Mm-hmm. Well, if I may say in a bit rough wording, well, Given that you have only 95% of your graph right, what are the chances that you get the final picture totally wrong?
So that's something I would usually also discuss in the lecture. There's not enough time here. That's a very good question, and the answer is there. For example, we have seen different centrality methods. Some of them are quite stable. For example, if you think of degree, if you change something in the network, then it only doesn't affect nodes which are far apart. Other ones are quite sensible. What's working quite well is, for example, the network motifs, because if you have small changes in the network, then you only have small changes in the frequency of occurrence of motifs usually. Whereas, for example, the counterexample is eccentricity centrality, where because eccentricity values, especially nodes in the center and especially these on bridges, very high, if you remove such a bridge, then you may change the eccentricity value of many different nodes. So it always depends on the methods, and usually you analyze also the stability of each method concerning changes of the network. So there's no general statement. It really depends always on the specific algorithm.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, I should thank you very much, Falk. It was a very nice lecture. And I think that we will have some short, I think, 10 to 15 minutes. 15 minutes break. You can discuss. And there was a suggestion from Daniil Laumov that participants can stand up here and tell for audience who is who and present themselves. If I not disagree, please, you can do it right now. Правильно я понял, да? Ну, тогда, может быть, Даниил, who is suggested, is the first. It's your...
I'm Daniil Naumov from Moscow. Actually, I will give you a practical course tomorrow. And in my work, I have deals with protein sequence analysis and particularly with enzymes which hydrolyze carbohydrates. I think it's enough.
My name is Yuri Gorshevsky. I'm from Minsk, Belarus. I'm dealing with docking algorithms, and I'll have a short presentation here. Thank you.
So my name is Ivan Anishenko. I come from Belarus, Minsk. I'm a third-year student of the Belarusian State University Physical Department, and I'm dealing with HIV and the visceral loop, and I'll give a presentation about it.
My name is Alexey Gakovenko. I'm from Moscow, Shemyakin-Ovchinnikov Institute for Baragonic Chemistry. I deal with, I'm a molecular biologist, and deal with cell differentiation, cancer cells, and other. Thank you.
Somebody else?
I'm from Institute of Genomics in Delhi, India, and I'll be giving a lecture on application bioinformatics for infectious diseases.
I'm Luciano Milanesi from CNR in Italy. I will give a lecture on grid applications in bioinformatics.
Пожалуйста, еще желающие. Окей.
Hello, I'm Alexey Ivanov from Moscow, Institute of Biomedical Chemistry. I will give the lecture about the pipeline from analysis of genomes to drug design. Thank you.
Okay. Please, Stefan.
I'm Stefan Hinrich. I'm coming from EML Research in Heidelberg, and I will give the lecture in the tutorial on Monday about protein similarities. My background is protein crystallography and protein ligand interactions, so coming from the 3D part of proteins.
Okay. Thank you. Any more brave persons? Yep. So I think students are sitting quiet. Okay. I think that we will listen for them on the students' presentation section. Okay. And as for me, I'm Dmitry Afonikov. You probably know me. And I am responsible for all the bad things on the school. And other people are all responsible for all good things. So please ask me questions if any problems you have, and I will try to resolve this. Okay, maybe have a short break for just walking here. And some maybe you can ask some questions in person to Falk about your his lectures. Please, we have 10 minutes to break. Okay.
Today is the holiday, and it's not a problem with connection. Okay. I will just try to find out. Is it you?
So the shorter overview, so that gets you easy. No, okay, Wait a minute. Is it? Oh. Another one, it's another. So,
just make a list of them.
Novo, the first lecture, summer lecture.
Okay, just one. And won't you agree to put it on the DVD and to share?
You can do this, but at the moment I prepared 3 lectures. I think I will only present the first 2 lectures.
Okay.
Then you have to delete the last lecture. So I'm prepared for 3, but I think the time is only for 2.
Okay.
So then you have to delete the last slides. You will see this. You can open it.
I just put it on my...
Okay.
To
then we open it and then I'll show you. So this is the first. Let me see. Let's go to that. Can't see nothing. Wait. This is the Oh, yeah, this is the second, mm-hmm. And then there is a third, and I think I will not come to the third, but it doesn't matter here, it's the third, and then you have to delete this,
okay.
Partial prediction alignment.
Okay.
So I will more or less I will focus to modeling of metabolic networks using automata and Petri. And this is, we have to delete, this is enough. Okay. So,
just...
this?
No, not just
this one. Yeah.
This information
that you put. That's it.
Okay.
So I can put this out?
Just a minute.
Yeah. And finally, we can go to the first slide because I think we're not coming.
Actually,
now we are, but I will not present.
Actually, all the people
So it's fine. I have it, and you are also free.
Yeah. Okay. And you just tomorrow you should sign.
Yeah. Okay. I have to do this tomorrow. Yes. I will come tomorrow. Let me say around 11-12 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
Something like this. Let me do this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Хорошо, я попробую узнать. Хорошо.
У нас на самом деле есть еще мальчик, который остается еще в Канаде.
Что вы должны сделать? Здесь ситуация такая, здесь 7,5 тысяч по 200 евро по сегодняшнему курсу, 120 я начал сделать. А вам то же самое, вы Кулаковский, да, Иван? Билеты. Да. Мы копию сделаем. Мы сейчас.
Just sent an email if you hear the questions. Thanks.
Is the same, so you added just a constant.
Or is it actually better in terms of building
So it's just better in practical
But when you have a really huge network, they are really huge.
Yeah, but always the best case.
And a bit of generalization of that question. Can the biological data that you have your knowledge of how the cell works, can it reduce the complexity of your problem? So can you find actually new ways of solving your problems, or is it still the same thing?
The problem is that again, in theory, it's the same thing. If you detect this, in theory, you never know how to do it.
You do actually know something. For example, you know how the process in cell are. You know that there are such things as DNA that transcripts to proteins, and there are classes of that proteins and etc. etc. You actually have some knowledge.
Yes, but not.
In terms of Bayesian, let's say you have some probabilities that. A priori probabilities.
But again, even probabilities. Well, you just think of big
probabilities. Probability and complexity is too different. So you can do that at least.
But for practical terms, again, yes, you can use this information because there are two directions. First is that. For example, for some networks, the small world, you can maybe take advantage of this. But it's also that
maybe in Deutsch, I know it
in Deutsch. No, I had a thought, but I was thinking already the next one. Anyway, so I'm sure, and the other one you could do, and that's what people also are doing, is you can use samples.
Yeah.
If you, for example, know that your network is again, maybe statistical policies, but it's somehow that you can just take the sub network, part of the network, and it more or less shows the same properties as the whole network. Then you can use sample, so you only compare things for the sub network, and then you compare for the complete network. So in this terms, it helps you.
So
but not really in the pure theoretical complexity.
I see. So how large the box can you actually analyze?
Only if you say the ones I showed you, 1,000 nodes and motifs of size 4 or 5, this works quite well. And if you use it then and do the parallel computation, you can even leave it.
So where's the
3-4 times larger and maybe the motive size is going to be larger. But you can only do a network with 100,000 nodes and try to calculate if the motive size is quite big. So for this one, I don't know. There are already some papers there. So
actually, the cell can do the computation for you if you provide it with some input, you increase the level of some proteins, etc. Mm-hmm. It can give you the response. That can give you information about the structure.
Let us see. I think I have.
So, the regulatory escape, etc. It can do it instead of you. Right? Mm-hmm. Or no?
And what you can do with this is, I think you can use this information to make the. For example, the motive analysis finally, because then you can say you're not only interested
in verification, you mean?
For classification, or you're saying you are now interested in motives with the additional information on the edges, and the information on the response or response intensity. And then you may be able to have some computation be done yourself, because you can easily fit them specific parts. But nobody has done it. There would be something completely new.
It's fun.
So, our further plan is to have, ladies and gentlemen, our next lecture will be the analysis of metabolic networks by Ralf Hofestad, professor from Bielefeld University, and it will be for the 1 half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a coffee break, and we will get a coffee break after that, and we will go to the seminar after that at 5 o'clock. Okay, please have a nice lecture. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think we are all tired, and let us go to the second round. I prepared 3 lectures, but I think I have time for 2. We will see. And the key idea is to discuss how can we model metabolic networks. And what is the reason that this is a key question for bioinformatics? What is the vision of bioinformatics? I think the vision is to think about a virtual cell, a cell inside the computer. So we have a lot of information. Here we see on top 2 database integration. I would say here more or less nothing in my lectures. Olga Krebs will focus to this topic.
But we have around 1,000 databases now available in the internet. That means data is coming from all sides, more and more. And your generation has to handle the data. But having the data, this is only a static representation. The question is, how can we bring life into the data? That's the question. And until now, the answer is open. Which methods are useful to model metabolic networks? And if you studied or if you study computer science, then it's normal to use, let me say, automata, formal languages automata. And I will focus in the first lecture to cellular automata. And the second lecture will present the idea of the Petri nets. What is the reason that I will focus mainly to the Petri nets? The Petri nets are able to join both ideas, the discrete modeling idea, and the automata is a discrete model, and let me say the word of the mathematical guys, using differential equations to find the exact simulation of what is going on. But if you take a look into all these databases, you will see that we do not have, at the moment, do not have the data, the kinetic data, to come up with differential equations. So that's the idea of the talk, to present the main methods of computer science for this task. Ah, yeah, with this little map, I would like to say, where is Bielefeld? Perhaps you can read it. It's hard to read, but Bielefeld is here. Let me say, normally I say it's between Cologne or Bonn, our former capital, and Berlin. Where is Berlin? Here. Yeah. And if you use the train, it's more or less half of this distance. So it's Bielefeld. And here's one more picture. Our university is one big beton building. So normally the German universities are very old, but this is one of the youngest German universities, and that's the reason that they came up with this building outside of the city, and all faculties are, let me say, inside this building. And this is the good news. It will take me not longer than 2 minutes to reach any colleague. That's the good news. The bad news is it's only beton, huge beton. But when my Mexican friend visited me for the first time, he said, oh, this is science fiction. So for him, for a guy from Mexico, this is science fiction. For other guys, it's a terrible situation. Okay. And perhaps this picture is showing the center of this building. And it's like a train station. So you have shops and so on inside and so on. So it's nice. Yes, I also included again this slide, only to say compute bioinformatics is more or less in Germany not only to use the methods of computer science in the field of biology. It's also the opposite. So that means we will pick up or trying to pick up ideas coming from biology to solve problems in computer science. And so a few keywords are, for example, DNA computing, genetic algorithms, neural networks. The ideas are coming from directly from biology. How can we solve hard problems and p-compute problems and so on? And on the other side, you will see the definition of the cellular automata, or the finite automata, is also coming from people, mathematical guys, working in the field of biology. We will see this. I will present the example of the cellular automata, L systems, and so on. In Germany, we have the situation that we have around 17 universities where you can study bioinformatics now. It's more or less the number. And perhaps more or less 55 institutes which are doing research in the field of computer bioinformatics. That's more or less the actual situation. And to be honest, my feeling is that we produce too many students in the field of bioinformatics because we have only a few companies. That's the main problem. That means if you study bioinformatics and then you look to a company where you can work, it's not so easy because thousands of students are coming out. And if you take a look, for example, to Great Britain, a lot of German computer scientists are now working in Great Britain because we produce a high number of these kinds of students. So what is at the moment the main task of bioinformatics? I think we have to understand the correlation between the genotype and the phenotype.
how does the genotype influence the phenotype? Or if you take a look to the phenotype, if you go to the doctor, this is what he is doing, he will take a look to the phenotype first, and what is the disease and what is the reason for the disease and so on. Or on the other side, if you think about drugs, what is the drug doing? And this is still an open question. It's interesting, if you would take a drug, normally no one knows what is going on. And what is more interesting, that the guys from medicine are saying now, this keyword, individual medicine, that normally each person needs his own drug. So, however, we do not understand what the drug is doing. But perhaps in the future we can do this, because having all this data, we can integrate the data, and perhaps we can not only think about the correlation of the genotype and phenotype, we can also think about this, what is the drug, a specific drug, doing inside these processes. And the same with the food. If we eat something, what is going on? Yes, which genes will switch on and off? You are laughing, but it's the EU is thinking about a specific project, and 1 year ago, they organized a meeting in Brussels, and they invited a lot of scientists, also myself. And it was not clear for me what is the topic of this workshop. And each guy from different fields, we had to present what is going on, in my case, in bioinformatics. And at the end of the workshop, Patermann showed up, the guy from the EU, from food, agriculture, and biotechnology. He said, what is your feeling? Is it now the right time to think about a big proposal so that we will give money, and at the end that we will understand what is going on if we, for example, eat an apple? If you eat an apple, what is going on in the metabolism? So they are thinking in this direction. Okay. What I already said, if you take now a look to the internet, you will find around 1,000 database information systems which are available. And if I just think back, when I was in, let me say, in your age, there was a gene bank, but you had to buy more or less a specific memory, a CD or something like this. So you are living in a totally new world. The internet and all these possibilities and all the data is available over the whole world. It's a new world. And this world is not very old. It's 10 years old, not older. Okay. So that means if we focus to this genotype-phenotype correlation and to the questions, what is the drug doing, you can find a lot of information systems for gene regulation, for metabolic pathways, for drugs, and so on. So there's a lot of information around. That's the message. Oh, that was too much. Yes, and again, having all these database information systems, and the next question is, how can we realize a user-specific integration? If we are in contact with a specific guy from medicine or from biology, this guy has a specific view, and his interest is only, let me say, to focus to a few databases and only to a few data inside the database. So the user-specific integration is of importance. That's the message. And we call this integrative bioinformatics. This, let me say, subset of bioinformatics, which is taking care exactly of this question. And there are also other keywords. If you focus to computer science, you will find keywords like data mining, information fashion, and so on. But it's more or less the same. How can we integrate specific data from specific database systems or information systems? Yes, here in this case, before I focus to the urea cycle, and in this case, this slide is only showing what is possible. Let me say a few slides before you say the simple urea cycle coming from the KEK database. And now we can think about this. Let us go into different database systems and find more information around the urea cycle, for example. We do not have to go into the detail, but it's clear. Information coming from drug databases, information coming from the literature, and so on. This is what we have to do, to integrate, to look for more information around the specific metabolic pathway where we have our interest. That's the idea, only to say this. Yes, database integration, I said already, I will not focus to database integration, but if we take a look to the literature, we will see that there are a lot of projects and also tools available. And I will focus only to the SAS tool from Lion Bioscience. It's now not Lion Bioscience, it's now a company from Great Britain, because Lion Bioscience disappeared. And this is also good, bad news for bioinformatics. This was the biggest and the first German company for bioinformatics, and this company failed and disappeared. So it's also a disaster, but that's it. And Pedant is a product from Biomax. This is the good news. Biomax is also a German company, still running, and they had another philosophy. Lion Bioscience had the philosophy, we will do more or less a lot of work in the field of bioinformatics, and we will pick up stock money. And they went to the stock market and picked up millions of dollars and euros. And then they burned the millions. The other company, Biomax, did not go to the stock market and did not go to the venture capital market. And this was from the beginning a company, let me say, growing slowly. And this company is still alive. However, finally, this SRS system could be used, if you think about database integration, this Pedant system can be used, and a lot of other tools are available. And perhaps let us discuss this deeper if Olga will present her tool, and I will not focus to this topic anymore. Our main subject over the years was modeling and simulation of metabolic pathways and networks, and we organized different special seminars, international seminars. And 1995, this was the first international seminar, and this was the first time that I met Nikolai Kauchanov. We also invited Nikolai Kauchanov, and this was the beginning of our cooperation, more or less. And based on the first three seminars, we published together with Colaro Vides a specific book, and more or less this is a summary of the first three seminars. So if we think about all the models which are available, then if you study computer science, more or less formal languages, automata, this is the world you are living in, and these are the tools which you normally use. And now in the first part, I would like to focus to the cellular automata, and we will see, I will introduce the cellular automata, and then I will pick up, let me say, the basic example. It's the first paper of Stuart Kaufman when he presented his idea of the linear automata. It's a one-dimensional cellular automata to study gene regulation processes. Or on the other side, this one-dimensional automata will be an extremely abstract model of gene regulation. It's totally abstract and totally discrete. We will see this. Modeling and simulation. If we take a look to biology, I think if you take a look to this pipe, this is the normal way. You have a problem, you have a hypothesis, and then you do experiments, and you make observations, have data, analysis again, and then you have perhaps a solution, or you have to make more experiments, and so on. So simulation and modeling is giving you, let me say, this extra slot. And that means if you implement your model, then you have a hypothetical world inside the computer, and perhaps you can do in this hypothetical world, experiments which you cannot do in reality. This is, let me say, the extension, perhaps, of this normal scientific workflow. And this is also the idea of systems biology at the moment, to say, okay, we will not only do experiments, or we will try to do experiments in this hypothetical world to come faster to a result. That's the idea. So, if we think about discrete models and the modeling of metabolic networks, and then if we take a look to the literature, we will find black box models, simple black box models, graph theoretical models. Falk presented the graph theory already, or formal languages and automata. This is the world of computer science. Or you will also find specific methods of artificial intelligence, but we will now focus to the automata. And again, who is the founder? Or who was the scientist who defined the cellular automata? It was John von Neumann. Who does not know who is John von Neumann? So everyone knows. The founder of our computer. And the idea, the main idea was he would look for a discrete model. This model had to be parallel. This is a difference to the von Neumann computer. The von Neumann computer is not working in parallel, it's working sequentially. Set of cells, so the idea is to work with a set of cells, and each cell will represent a state, a finite set, or a finite automata. I will first define the finite automata. So that means John von Neumann presented his definition based on the definition of the finite set, the finite automata. I will define this first. And the application field of the cellular automata is a very wide area. So normally the physics, like until now, liked to use cellular automata. So epidemiology, self-reproduction, population dynamics, and so on. So it's a wide area. So the basic definition of the cellular automata came from Kleene from 1953, and he published his definition of the finite automata. And the finite automata is also a basic tool for computer scientists, because if you think about a programming language, the compiler, one part of the compiler is a finite automata, the part which has to recognize all words of a language. This is exactly a finite automata. So a finite automata represents a tape, a reading head, and a control unit, and this is the formal definition of Kleene, saying we have a finite alphabet, normally we use 0 and 1, we have a finite set of states, we have a start state, normally it's Q0, and we have a subset of Q, which is representing the final state so that the machine will stop, and we have the function, or sometimes it's a relation, a subset from Q over sigma over Q, that means the machine is in a specific state, and the read head will read the next symbol, then the machine will go into the next state, Q. I have an example for this behavior. Here you see we have the tape, and the tape can represent elements from sigma, from the working alphabet, which is a finite set. We have this reading head, so at the moment the machine will read the symbol inside this cell. And then we have the state of the finite automata. It's a symbol over this alphabet Q, and this is what we already said, is the relation saying what the, how the system will react. Here is a simple example. At the moment, we will read this letter A. The automat is representing the state Q3, and we will find a relation like this, Q3, and if we are in Q3, and if we read A, then the system will go to Q4. So the next configuration of the system will be this. We are in Q4. The reading head will go to the next position, and so on. And the machine will accept this word if the machine will read all the symbols, and then finally the machine will represent a final state. This is the idea of a finite automata. So John von Neumann studied finite automatas, and then he had the idea to go further, because his wish was to think about a parallel automata. So the cellular automata is more or less a set of finite automatas, a finite set of finite automatas. Each finite automata will represent a state Q and is connected with neighbors. So we have a set of finite automatas, and the finite automatas are linked to other finite automatas. This is the neighborhood. And finally, we will change the state or the configuration of the cellular automata. That means if we take a look to a specific cell, and then if we took a look to the neighbors, that's the reason that we have here N, then we will change to a next state. So the neighborhood is normally the von Neumann neighborhood or the Moore neighborhood. I will show what the meaning about this. Simulations allow a dynamically neighborhood. So there are also simulation environments which will say, okay, this is the basic definition of John von Neumann, but we will also allow a dynamic neighborhood, not a fixed neighborhood. It's also possible. Then there's always a question about the border. Normally, the border will be a torus, but it must not be a torus. It depends on the implementation of the cellular automata. Generation. To go to the next generation, that means all the cells will change their state independently and in parallel. So that's the reason that I wrote here quasi-parallel. So more or less parallel. This is the neighborhood, the von Neumann neighborhood. So von Neumann normally worked with the neighborhood to take a look to the left, to the right, to the upper, and to the down cell. This is the Moore neighborhood. More or less, you will take a look to all neighbors of a cell. And normally, you will implement a cellular automata based on the torus. That means the left neighbor of this cell is this cell, the right neighbor of this cell is this cell, the upper cell of this cell, and so on. But it must not be a torus. So normally, if we have to model a realistic situation, then we have to think about, first of all, about the dimension of the cellular automata. So the example of Kaufmann will present a one-dimensional automata, but normally I think you will play or use a two-dimensional automata, sometimes a three-dimensional automata. But it is clear, if you will go to a higher dimension, then you have problems with the time complexity, if you implement this automata. The neighborhood, we said normally we use the von Neumann neighborhood, but you can also define your own neighborhood. Then you have to define the states. And here, more or less, there exists a rule, don't define too many states, because if you have more and more states, then you have also, again, problems with the complexity, if you think about the implementation. And then you have to define rules. Yeah, we saw this delta. A few numbers here. Number of rules. Let K be the number of states. So this is Q for each cell. And N be the number of neighbors. Then you have K over N. Potential rules. So a lot of rules. Here we have an example. If you take a look to a binary automata and look to the von Neumann neighborhood, then we have around 65,000 rules. And if we switch to the Moore neighborhood, we have 77 over 10 rules. So you see, if you play a little bit only with the number of neighbors, a little bit with the number of Q, then this has a specific effect. So John von Neumann came up with the cellular automata during the 50s. But the cellular automata became famous during the 70s when Conway presented his life game, the game of life. But let me also say that John von Neumann did not publish a lot of papers. Today, at the beginning, our chairman said, you have to publish to be successful. It's true, but it's not concretely true. I think if you take a look to guys like John von Neumann, or I have the example of Max of Röntgen. I don't know if it was Max Röntgen who was the founder of this Röntgen machine. Röntgen published only 4 papers. John von Neumann published more or less nothing about the cellular automata. His co-worker Birks published at the end, when he died, a book to show what he did with the cellular automata. And I will come up with one more example when I will discuss the Petri nets. Petri published also more or less nothing. So to have a very good idea is the first step. And if you have a good idea and then you publish, I think then it's fine. But today, a lot of people are publishing, but they never had an idea. This is the problem of our system at the moment. So publish is fine, but first come up with a good idea. So this guy, Conway, read perhaps the book of Birks about the cellular automata. And then he came up with this life game, the game of life. Who does not know the game of life? So I will only say a few words. The life game made the cellular automata famous. But however, as a computer scientist, we are also thinking about a parallel universal computer. And we can say that the cellular automata was the first universal parallel computer, so equivalent to the Turing machine. So that means that John von Neumann, the founder of this sequential computer, is also, let me say this, the first scientist which came up with the parallel computer, with the idea how can the architecture of a parallel computer look like. Okay, here you will find the link of a, there are a lot of implementations in the internet about the game of life, and moreover, if you are a computer scientist and if you are in the first semester, this is a standard exercise to implement the life game. But I picked this up from the internet, this slide, and I like this little simulation environment, because if you play with this tool, you will have a lot of fun. And here you see what is a cellular automata. Normally it's a two-dimensional automata, and there are rules. These rules for a space that is populated yellow, each cell with one or no neighbors dies, that means loneliness, or each cell with four or more neighbors dies, overpopulation, each cell with two or three neighbors survives, and then for a space that is empty at the moment or unpopulated, black, each cell with three neighbors becomes populated. These are the rules, and if you implement the rules, then you can, let me say, you can produce the generations and then you can see what is going on. And what is interesting, and this made this life game famous, that you can come up with specific structures. For example, the block will never change. The block, if you have a block, then you have the block. It will never change. Or this blinker has this configuration. The next step, this will die and this will die and this will come up and this will come up. So you have specific configurations which will survive. And so this was more or less the reason that the annual conference, I don't know if the annual conference is still going on, but they came up with annual conferences and the people came up with specific structures to show what is going on. Let me say this. And this made the cellular automata famous, and based on Conway's life game, scientists from different subjects picked up this cellular automata idea, and since this time, a lot of scientists are using cellular automata. Yes, here only a few comments about computing and complexity. So we focus a little bit to computer science. Normally we have a problem. And what we have to do as a computer scientist, we have to find an algorithm. And if we find the algorithm, then we will implement the algorithm, then we have a program. And this is more or less a solution. We implement a program using a specific computer, and then we can solve the problem. But if we think about the first step, there's a problem, and we have to find the algorithm. Then there's the question, do we have problems which we cannot solve? That means where we can never find an algorithm. And until the beginning of the last century, the humans thought, no, it's no problem. So it was more or less the idea of Leibniz. We will ever find, to each problem we will find a calculus. And then if we have the calculus, let us calculate. This was what the humans thought until the beginning of the last century. So give me a problem, I will solve it. It's no problem. But Goethe came up with the first proof and showed during the 20s that there are problems which we can never solve. So since this time we use it, there are a lot of problems and we will never find an algorithm. It's not possible. So and then Church, Turing, and all these guys came up with their thesis, if a problem is intuitive, computable, it will be Turing machine computable. That means if it is intuitive computable, then we will find a Turing machine and we will solve the problem. And the cellular automata is equivalent to the Turing machine. I will not show this, but this is the reason that the cellular automata is the first parallel universal computing formalism. This was, and then the other problem, if you have an algorithm, then it's a question of complexity, and you know this, most of the interesting problems also in computers, in bioinformatics have, let me say, exponential complexity. And if you think about the simulation of metabolic networks, we have exactly this situation. I will skip this Turing machine. Let us go further. But only this slide. This slide is showing, you know, we have also the guys from the parallel computing. But this slide is showing that parallel computing will not help. It will help a little bit, but it will not help to solve the complex problems. If our problem has a complexity, let me say, of 2 over n, then this is no problem for us. You will see, you can, if n is 10, 30, 50, 80, 100, this is no problem. It's not 1 second, and we will solve the problem. But if we have an exponential problem, this is already a problem. If you think about n is 30, you need already years. And now take a look to this. If the technology will go from, let me say, the instruction here to execute the instruction, we need 1 microsecond. And then we say, now we have a better technology. We have 1 nanosecond. This will help a little bit. Yeah? But if you have n 50, then you have again years. But if you have n 80, then you can forget it again. And if the technology will go from nano to pico, you will have the same situation. So that means parallel computing will help you if this n will not be very high. So then it will help. But if you have an n more than 100 or 1,000, it will never help. This is now an example, the so-called forest fire model of a one-dimensional cellular automata. And so the idea is that we would like to model the situation that there is fire in the forest. Yes, that means, first of all, we have states. T is a tree, and B is burning, and this E is an empty place. And that means normally a tree will burn, and if a tree is burning, then this place will be empty. Yeah? And it's a question of time, and then perhaps a new tree will come up. So if we would like to simulate the situation that fire is in the forest, we need 3 states, and we will use, let me say, perhaps a 2-dimensional automata, and then we can simulate this. Moreover, we need probability. The probability, the lightning probability, that means that a tree will go from T to F. And we need an increased probability, that means that the empty place will be a tree again. Yeah. So F and P is 2 parameters. And then we have to think about the rules, and here we have 4 simple rules. Each burning tree B will go into an empty place, that means B will go into E. The first rule, each tree T will be a burning tree if at least 1 neighbor is burning. So if your neighbor is burning, then you will also burn. If there is no neighbor burning, a tree will burn at the probability F, so then we need the probability F at the beginning. So something happened. And the empty place will be a tree at the probability P. And then you can play with this P and F, and that means first if P and F is smaller than 1, the simulation will produce specific waves. Or second, fire will delete fire. You can also simulate this effect that you can give one fire will delete the other fire. Things like this you can simulate. We're not going into the depths here. It's only the first little idea how we can come up with a cellular automata, with a model. And this forest fire model is one of the famous models similar to the live game. Or if F is 0 and P not too small, then you have only forest, and so on. You can play with this. So I said at the beginning that I will focus to, let me say, the first paper of Stuart Kaufmann from 1969. I think it is more or less the first paper. And we have to go back 1969. We had the knowledge of more or less the operon regulation. So 1969, we had the information of the genetic code. This was the time. And for him, he tried to discuss the question of gene regulation. So first of all, we have genes like the operon, lac operon, and then for him it was a question how many genes will take influence of other genes. So more or less this was his question. And he tried to discuss this question totally abstract with a discrete model. And we take a look to this discrete model, and he used 1969, just before the Conway live game, he used the one-dimensional cellular automata. So that means that he read as a student this book from Burks. That's my feeling. I don't know, but I think so. So, and he called this the Boolean networks, and you know that this Stuart Kaufman, I think he published hundreds of books and thousands of papers, so he's the father of this theory, Boolean networks. So this was the beginning of the whole story. And if you take a look to the internet and to the literature, you will find hundreds of papers. Once I met him 10 years ago, then I asked him, tell me, how many co-workers do you have? And what do you think? What was his answer? What do you guess? Guess a number.
One.
1-0, he said. So you see, you can only be successful if you work alone. 0. No secretary, nothing. I was surprised. I thought 100 or something. This was interesting. He said 0. Only me. Perhaps it is now different, but around 10 years ago. So he focused to a one-dimensional cellular automata, again, 1969, and then he said, okay, the gene is modeled by Q, that means two states, 0 and 1. 0 has the meaning the gene is off, and 1, the gene is on, finally. And inputs are coming from other genes, that is the neighborhood, finally. And he used a dynamic neighborhood, and he used also a dynamic rule set. So this was different to the standard definition of von Neumann. If you take a look to the standard definition of John von Neumann, it's fixed. The neighborhood is fixed, and also the rule set is fixed. He made this a little bit different. And this is the reason that he called his automata switching nets. K inputs, he chose the K inputs by random. So it's not the von Neumann neighborhood, left and right and so on. It's for each cell, random, let me say, neighborhood. And then also there's the rule set, K over 2 over 2, and he is also choosing the rules for each cell also by random. This was so a little bit different to the standard definition. So number of genes which will influence the activity of other genes, this was his question. So 1969. And again, this luck operon was just announced, and if you take a look to the luck operon, there's only one operator inside. So it's clear, our feeling is the answer of his paper cannot be 100 or 200, because during 69 there was the message the luck operon has one operator gene. So, and if you work in the field of modeling and simulation, you have this problem always that the people are saying, okay, you are modeling, you are simulating. The critic is that you will always produce what you are looking for. This is what the people are saying. So the people doing experiments, they say, you are using models and simulation, you will exactly do what you are looking for. And in this case, we will see his result will be K2 or 3. That means that there is only a relation to 2 or 3 other genes. This is the result of his paper, or one result. And in this case, it is true, 1969, if he would came up with 20 or 100, everyone would say, this guy is crazy, could not be. But today, if we take a look to this TransFAQ, or you have also a similar database here in TRRD, in Kochanov's lab, and take a look to the higher genes, then it's clear that you have a lot of transcription factors. So today, K2 or 3 would not be the result. If you will come up with a similar paper today, K must be, I don't know, 20 or something like this. So each gene is input of all other genes. So he came up in his paper with different simulations. So all other genes, that means each gene depends on all other genes. This is his first simulation. Then one input per gene,
so that only one gene will influence one other gene, two inputs per gene, that the two genes will influence one gene, and so on. But he simulated only all other genes, or 1, 2, and 3. So this is later his K parameter. And again, so active gene is 1, so this gene is active, inactive gene is 0, all the other genes are inactive at the moment, and then form a genetic network, a set N of elements of a network, and a set K of inputs, and each gene receives K, and in this case K is 0, because this gene is influenced by this gene and by this gene, and that's the reason that K is 2. That's the definition. And what we said before, that this neighborhood is chosen by random. That means if he is playing with K2, that means the influence can come, let me say, from this gene to this gene, or from this gene. It's chosen by random. It's not the von Neumann neighborhood. But if you can also think about the von Neumann neighborhood. But it's clear. If you think about the DNA, we have another situation. Normally, you can say a gene from another chromosome can have influence to this gene. So the von Neumann neighborhood is not a good idea. So that's the reason that he came up with a random neighborhood. Conditions, K inputs will be selected by random for each gene. What we said, for each gene, one Boolean function will be selected. So also the reaction of a cell is defined a little bit by random. All genes will be calculated in the same time. It's the definition of a cellular automata. And then we have a state, it's a vector of n genes during a specific time. And that means we have n over 2 different states. Here we can see the functions. If we have K2, that means these are, we have 4 over 2 different functions, and by random, we will say, okay, this is the reaction function for this cell, or this is the reaction function for this cell. Yeah, and this is different to the cellular automata. Normally, the cellular automata will say, okay, we will choose here one function, and all the cells have to use the same function. But you can do this. Yes, and then he came up with his results in this paper, completely connected, K is N. Such a network has no practical relevance. This was his message, and he also focused to other papers, a paper from Rubin, 1952-4. We do not have to go into the details. Finally, he said K like 1 is also not of practical relevance. A lot of behavior cycles are coming up or showing up. K2, short cycles, that's not bad. K3, cycles are longer, and the number of cycles is similar to K2. So finally, he said K2 or 3, that's it. And that the interpretation is that his message was, if we take a look to the Lac operon, we can see 1, but in the future we will find a lot of operons with 2 or 3 or not more operator genes. Yes, he also came up with other results, but let us go to the next lecture. So this was my example, the example of the paper of Stewart Kaufmann, and I think it's also important for the students to see, if you have a simple idea, and this was a simple idea, to come up with this simple automata. Yes, but the simple idea and a nice paper can be the start point of a career, and the best example is Stewart Kaufmann. Okay, now we switch to the Petri nets. The cellular automata is an extremely abstract model, and it is too abstract if you think about metabolic networks. We cannot use it. But if you think about modeling and simulation, it's always the question of abstraction level. And if you have not a lot of information, or if you would like to have an abstract model, then perhaps you can use automata, cellular automata, finite automata. Perhaps it is making sense. But in the case of metabolic networks, now we have a lot of information. And if you take a look to the literature, you will see different models which are trying to model perhaps more or less exactly metabolic networks. And most of the papers in the literature are using differential equations to simulate specific metabolic networks. But I already mentioned that until now we do not have exact kinetics. And even if you take a look to database systems like Brenda and so on, you will find kinetic values. But these kinetic values are produced outside of the cell. That means no one knows if the kinetic value is the same if this enzyme is inside the cell. So even if you have values, it's not clear if they are good enough. So the idea here is to think about a discrete model which is also able to represent the quantitative aspect. And the Petri net is exactly, it's my feeling, exactly the model which can be used if you have discrete information, and perhaps in the future you will have more information, then you can extend easily this model. And this is what I would like to show. So the second path, the path aligner and so on, will be skipped. I will only focus now to the Petri net, and this is the second lecture, and then the time is over. Okay, what I already said. Now we focus to the Petri net and finally to the hybrid model. That means it's a combination of a discrete model and an analytical model. And this, I think this is one reason that the Petri nets are already strong and that they will be very strong in the future if we think about simulation of metabolic networks. So what is a Petri net? It's a specific graph, and we have two different nodes. Yes, we have places and transitions. And what you can see here already is a place will link to a transition and not to a place. And the transition will always link to a place and not to a other transition. Here we can see the next definition. If you have a condition, then this condition can be satisfied, then a token will show up. That means this condition, this token is saying this condition is satisfied. And if the condition is satisfied, the transition can fire. They say can fire or can have his action. Can fire, that means the token will consume, will disappear in the precondition, and then tokens will show up in the postcondition. And you see two tokens are showing up in this postcondition because the reason is that here the number 2 is placed to this arc. And here you can already see that we can bring information to the arcs. And we will do this later. Okay, application fields. The Petri nets are used, let me say, in a lot of different application areas. But let us think about Petri himself. What was the reason that during the 60s this guy Adam Petri came up with this theory? Petri was the head of the computer center of the University of Bonn. And during the 60s the operation system was not what it is today. So that means a lot of deadlocks blocked the whole system. And he thought, how can I, let me say, predict deadlocks? How can I detect deadlocks as soon as possible? And he studied mathematics also in Bonn. And then he thought, okay, I have to look for my own formalism. And then he came up with his formalism. And it was not called Petrinet at the beginning. He developed his formalism only to solve his problem, to detect the deadlocks and so on. So, and he used this theory, and this theory was finally his PhD thesis, and that's it. And he published nothing. He solved his problem, let me say this. But during this time, a German scientist came back from U.S. only for 1 year to stay back and worked in the same lab. And this guy read the PhD thesis of Petri, and he said, this is a great theory. And then this guy published a paper and called the theory Petrinet. And a lot of guys are saying that he, until now, he's still alive, is very angry about himself, that he made Petri famous. So this is the story of Petri. And later he published a few things. And he is famous in Germany, let me say this. But he published only a little bit. And if we think about the Nobel Prize of Computer Science, the Nobel Prize of Computer Science is the Turing Medaille. And until now, no German could win the Turing Medal. I don't know the situation about the Russian scientists, but no German. But Petri was, I think, twice on the list. And he did not win the Turing Medal. My feeling is because he published less. Okay. So let us go further. What is the Turing PetriNet? So we said already, it's a specific graph. We have places and transitions. And I said it important is arcs are only allowed between transitions and places. And then we can come up with this definition, the net definition. A net is a triple, and we already said, so it's places, transitions, and then this F is a subset of the set P, Cartesian product PT, and TP is what we said, that we have links from places to transitions and from transition to places, and not more. Again, we have places, we have transitions, and then we have these arrows or links between places and transitions. And yes, we will see. We can, for example, define a capacity for each place. That means we can place an interval, 5 to 500, to a place. That means that never less than 5 tokens have to be inside a place and never more than 500. So intervals can be placed. We will see this later. We call this PetriNet with capacities. Or a weight for every arrow. We saw this already, that the integer value will be placed to the arrows. And finally, we need the initial marking. So that means we have to place at the beginning a few tokens into this net, and then the system can run. So at the beginning, a simple example. And the example is now, let me say, very actual, because here we try to model the situation that you have a car and you need petrol. And at the moment, there's hope that you will pick up petrol at the petrol station. But you all know the petrol is becoming more and more expensive. Russian is becoming more and more rich, but the future is perhaps that the petrol station will have no petrol, but let us think there is petrol. So it means you need petrol, and here you see a transition. This transition has no preconditions. That means sometimes the patrons are saying nothing about the time. And this is normally, if you think about computer science, computer scientists normally say nothing about the time. Time is not our subject. And it's the same here. This transition can fire any time, and no one says when. So that means if it will fire, that means a car is coming to the petrol station. And this is also a little bit reality. No one knows when the next car will come. So the next car will come, that means the token will show up here. And then the car is going to the petrol station, then drive up to a pump. You have to drive up to a pump. But then we have to have a free space. There must be a free space. If there are a lot of cars, then you cannot, you are in the line to go to the pump, but it's not possible to go to the pump. But then you have the pump, and then you can fill up your car, and then here you see filled cars at the pump, and then you have to pay, and again, this cashier must be free, so you have to wait perhaps, and then you can pay, and if you pay, then you can leave again this petrol station, and then here you will see if you will leave, if you go to the exit way, then this token will go back to the free space. So that means with this simple PetriNet, we can simulate the situation that you are going to the petrol station and you will pick up petrol. So here we have a situation. A car just came to the petrol station and we see three places are free and another guy just paid. We can say just paid, the cashier is free. So that's the situation. So that means here, this transition can fire. That means you can go to a pump. It's possible. We are saying nothing about the time, but normally you say the next step, this guy will go to the pump. And here we can say, okay, this guy can go to the exit way, and then again, this token will go to the free place because he is going out. But it's not a must. Here you see, this transition can fire, is enabled. They say it's enabled. This transition is enabled, but the next configuration can be that only this transition will fire or this transition will fire. And that means if you have a big PetriNet, you always have to look which transitions are enabled. And then you have to think about the potential set of this set. And this is the complexity. If you think about this, this is now the representation of a metabolic network. To go to the next configuration, normally, if you are interested to see all possible reactions, you have to calculate the potential set. And then you will come up with an exponential growing tree. And that's not only the problem for patents, it's the problem for all these methods. If you would like to see everything, it's not possible until now. If you play with small networks, it's possible, but not with bigger networks than, I think, 500 nodes or something like this. Okay, you see, this in this situation, only this transition fired. Yes, one token disappeared, and this token could go to this place. And now this transition is enabled, and this transition is enabled. Here, this transition is enabled because both tokens are available. And now this transition fired, now this car is in the exit way, this token appeared here again in the free space, and so on. So let us go further. This is also good news. If you would like to play with PetriNets, you do not have to implement your own PetriNet. There are a lot of different PetriNets available, and here I only focus to one PetriNet, to this pipe PetriNet, pipe 2. This PetriNet is not so powerful, but it is for free. So you can directly use it, go to the internet, you can use it. I will give you also information about, let me say, the best PetriNet simulation environments, but in this case, normally you have to pay. But this pipe is good enough if you try to come up or come in contact with PetriNets. And this is only a picture from pipe, so if you will define your own PetriNet, normally you have a situation like this. We don't want now to go into the details, only to give you from the beginning also the message, if your network is very huge, you have also problems to see something and so on. So it's also a problem. But the theory of PetriNets allows also to say this transition, yeah, you can go into the depths. There are also hierarchies sometimes allowed. That means there is a network inside the transition. So then you can come up with a hierarchy, and then you can make it shorter. So it's also possible. But we will not discuss this here. Okay, this pipe is free and so on, open source, so that's the reason that I focused here to the pipe system. So this is now the fundamental definition of Petri and the PetriNet. That means we have a five-tuple. We have a net. We defined the net before. We have the start marking, this M0, and then we have this, we call it VK, is given each F a positive number. That means we can place integer numbers to the links, to the arrows. This is what is VK, this function, doing. Let N be such a PetriNet. M is a marking of place M, so the actual configuration. T is a transition of T, so it's one transition. We focus to one transition, we focus to one actual marking. And then we have to say transition T is activated or enabled under marking M, by this marking M, if for all pre-places of T, MP, so the actual tokens inside from P, is greater than VKPT. So this is more or less what we, the information which you can find on the link, on the arrow. We said perhaps there's a 2, a 3, a 5, or something like this. So if T, this transition is activated under M, T is allowed to fire. So we saw this in our example. If all preconditions have enough tokens, then the transition is activated. Then the transition can fire. We say nothing about the time. It can fire sometimes. And that's the reason that if we would like to see all possible reactions, that we have to focus to the potential set. And this is expensive. But we do not have to do this. We can also say, okay, we run and go through this graph and pick up only one pathway of this graph. So here, this is the exact definition of firing. So firing of a transition under M, the actual marking, will produce the marking M dash, That means we will go from one marking or configuration to the next configuration, and this transition T will fire. And what do we have to do? Here we see this situation. There's a precondition, and the precondition is also the postcondition. This is also possible. Yeah? We have a connection from P to T and from T to P. This is possible. But if we have such a situation, then we have this calculation, MP minus VKPT. This is what the number which we can find here, plus VKTP, the number which we can find at this position. And it's only a simple calculation process. And then this is a normal situation that a precondition will go to a transition when we have MP minus VKPT. This is also a normal situation. The transition is linked to a postcondition, and then we have MP plus VKTP, and otherwise nothing. So it's the definition of the firing process. And here we have now a simple biochemical reaction model. Let me say model. The glucose will go into glucose 6-phosphate, and this biochemical process will be catalyzed by hexokinase. And normally, hexokinase will go out of this process. That means hexokinase will not be consumed. That's the reason that we have hexokinase as pre and post condition. So we need ATP energy, and perhaps we have glucose, and hexokinase is there. Then this transition is enabled and can fire, and if it is, it will fire, we have this configuration or marking as a result. So that shows that simple biochemical reactions can simply modeled by Petri nets. And I already said, if we go back, we can think about concentrations. Here we have a totally discrete model. We can also think about the situation, let us play with a lot of tokens. So we have an abstract, let me say, abstract concentration value. So we are coming up with 100 tokens and or molecules, however we interpret it. And if we do this, then we can define something like yes, Petri nets using capacities, what I already said. Then we can place intervals to the places. That means the minima and the maxima value of tokens which can be inside of each place. That's the idea. Then we have to modify a little bit the activation and firing process, but it's only a little modification. Yes, here we can see, again, a simple biochemical process. And normally, if you take a look to the books or to the standard books, you will find the chemical language like this. Sometimes, perhaps, you will find a picture of this biochemical reaction. And here you can already see that we are very close, already very close to a Petri net representation. And if you think about the Boehringer metabolic pathway chart, which is very old, I don't know when the first edition appeared, the 70s, I think, or earlier. And if you think about this, who knows the Boehringer pathway chart? No one? It's similar to the Keck pathways, but to be honest, the Keck guys picked up all the data from the Boehringer pathway chart. Michael taught this when we stayed, I think, 98 together with Kanahishia in Darkstuhl. They did it and they never asked, so that's perhaps a normal way. But let me say, for me, it's interesting that the first papers using Petri nets for the representation of metabolic pathways came up at the beginning of the 90s. But if you take a look to the Boehringer pathway chart, and this pathway chart is normally over the whole world in most of the biochemistry labs, if you see this pathway chart, you see more or less a Petri net. So it's interesting that it took so long. So the next could be a simple graph representation. If you have this graph representation, you are close to a net representation, the first definition we played with. And if you have the net representation, you can go to a Petri net representation of this process. Yes, and perhaps you will also include these intervals. That means you will include There's a capacities if you're interested. And here we have a situation that this transition can fire. This transition can fire. This transition can fire because it's possible to delete one token because we still have two tokens inside, so we can fire this transition. And here we have a similar situation because here is zero, so we can also fire this transition. It's possible. And here it happened. And now, so this is one, let me say, advantage of the Petri nets. They are very close to the representation of biochemical reactions if you take a look to the pathway charts and so on. So it's easy to switch from the pathway chart to the Petri net. And you can do this more or less automatically. And the second advantage of the Petri nets is what I would like to show you here, is that the calculation process behind the Petri is very simple. It's simple linear algebra. So if you think about what we discussed here, if you think about a Petri net and we would like to produce the next configuration of the Petri net, what is going on? It's a simple linear algebra process. We have the actual situation or actual configuration, and then we have to realize a matrix multiplication of the net representation. I will show the net representation in the next slide. And we have this multiplication process with the so-called transition vector because we have to say which transition is going into action. So this is what we have to say, to go from the actual configuration to the next configuration. So simple linear algebra is behind the implementation of a Petri net. Or in other words, there's a theory behind linear algebra. If you think about object-oriented simulation environments, there's no theory and all the other things. Also rule-based systems. This is the second point, that the Petri nets are very strong. The third point is that there is, over the whole world, there are a lot of scientists still doing theory in the field of Petri nets. So theory is growing every day. So you do not have to take care of the theory. The results are coming permanently. And moreover, I think new simulation tools are also showing up. Okay, here we have a simple Petri net. And yes, what is the vector of the state marking? The vector is we have P1. This will be a 1. We have P2 is 0, P3 is 0, P4 is 0. So that means 1, 0, 0, 0. Then the transition matrix of the Petri net, we will show this. We will construct it. We can construct for each Petri net the transition matrix. And X is the vector which represents the firing transition. And if we take a look to this situation, here we can see that T1 and T2 are activated. But we have a specific situation. The theory of Petri nets will cause a situation conflict. We have only one token. Both transitions are activated, but only one transition can go into action because we have only one token. But for our vector, for the firing transition vector, we have two different vectors which are available, that the first transition is 0 or the second transition is 0. And all the other transitions is 1. All the other transitions are 0. So M0 is this. This X can be the situation that T1 will fire. And how do we construct the transition matrix? Here you see the places. Here you see the transitions. And how do we interpret this? So P1 and T1, the relation is that T1 will pick up tokens from P1. That's the reason that we will see here the -1. This is a Petri net without a specific marking on the arrows. That means if there is no marking, it's always 1. It's a standard definition. So here in this simple example, I was too lazy, but think about this. If you will see here a 3, then you will have here -3 and so on. So you have to bring the numbers into this transition matrix. And so on. So what is the reason that we have here the 0, P1, and T3? P1 and T3 are not, there's no connection, so it's zero, and so on. So, and if you think about the simulation environment and what is going on inside the computer, we always have this simple linear algebra. And we have always to calculate, we have to realize the matrix multiplication and so on. And here we have this example. This is the transition, and here we say that transition 1 will fire, and M0, the actual situation, was that the token was inside P1, and here the transition T1 fired, and that means the result is what is coming up. You can calculate it, you can see it, this is the result. If you would like to use the Petri-nets for the simulation of metabolic networks, then you have to think about a few extensions. I already mentioned that there are database systems which represent kinetic values. Or if you are in contact with colleagues from biochemistry, they will show up with a specific pathway and they will say, I'm doing experiments and I have kinetics. Then it's not a bad situation. You can say, okay, I will work with higher Petri nets, and then I will bring your values or your information into this higher Petri net, and then you are going into the direction of the analytical modeling of this pathway. But to be honest, if this guy from biochemistry is looking for totally realistic simulations, then you cannot use this kind of higher Petri nets. Because then this guy is looking for the exact time, for the exact concentration values. And then you have to use differential equations. But the first extension here is that we use the self-modification Petri nets. That means what we do is we use the names of the places more or less as variables. Yes, X or S. And if you think about our simple biochemical reaction example, there was an enzyme and we had a product. And normally if you have, let me say, thousands of enzymes, and if you will have here, let me say, no numbers, then you have to transfer one substance after the next to the right side. But this is not the realistic simulation. If you have thousands of enzymes, then you would like to use this dynamical number of tokens, also dynamical here on this side. So, and you can do this with the definition of self-modified Petri nets. That means you can use the name of any place as a parameter. And you can place this parameter, let me say, to this arc. And that means now what you see here, that if we have 5 tokens here inside this place and perhaps 100 here, then we can transfer directly X. X is dynamically 5 perhaps, then we can shift directly 5 substances to the right side. So we can do this dynamically, not step by step. And these kinds of Petri nets are called self-modified Petri nets. This is our example, which we mentioned before. So what we can do is we can place this hexokinase name exactly to the arcs, and then we have more or less a dynamic process. And then it's clear that you can extend also the self-modified Petri nets. The self-modified Petri nets, or the definition is already old, I think 20 years old. And then the next step is to extend this definition and allow to place, let me say, yes, normal functions, normal complex functions to the places. And then you are close to the old world of the differential equation simulations. And then you can come up with, let me say, complex functions, bring the complex functions to the errors, and then you have the mixture of the discrete world and the analytical world, which is in the future more and more of importance. This definition is only saying, okay, we can place now complex functions to the arcs of our Petri net. With this slide, I would like to say the last minutes we all normally we focus to biochemical reactions. And I said, if you take a look to the Boehringer pathway chart, you can see directly, you can realize the automatic translation to the Petri nets. But what is interesting, you can use the same simple formalism to model, let me say, gene regulation processes. This is also a more or less abstract, simple example how we can model a simple gene regulation process. But it's only to show you it is possible to use the same simple formalism for complex metabolic processes, for biochemical processes, and so on. So finally, for gene regulation processes, biosynthesis processes, and protein synthesis processes, we can use the same simple formalism. If you take a look to the available PetriNet simulation environments, this is a list of different simulation environments, but let us directly focus to, I think, to the best simulation environment. It's a cell illustrator. Now it's a product of the Japanese colleagues of Matsuno, and but former it was a product of the University of Ilmenau, the University of East Germany. So Petri came up with a theory in Bonn, but also in East Germany, a few professors worked in the field of Petri nets. And in Ilmenau, I think it's, if I take a look to Germany, it was the only place where they came up with a strong simulation environment. I don't know what was the reason that a few years ago they gave this tool to the Japanese, to Matsuno. Perhaps it was money or this professor retired. I don't know. And the other strong group in East Germany was at the Humboldt University. And after the unification, the Humboldt University transferred the pupil, the strongest pupil of Petri, to the Humboldt University. And now you can say in Germany, the Petri-nets, the strongest place of Petri-nets is the Humboldt University of Berlin. The message is, if someone of you would like to play with PetriNets, start with the pipe system. And if you have the feeling, oh, I like the PetriNets, then you have to think about the cell illustrator. It's the best system because the cell illustrator is, again, extending a little bit the theory of the PetriNets. It's called the hybrid PetriNet. You have also minus arcs and so on. And you can also use real numbers. So it's more or less, at the moment, the best simulation environment. I think that's the urea cycle, but we do not have to go into the depths of this. And I think that's it from the time. So I don't want to present the third lecture. We have more or less, the time is over, 5 minutes, I think, and that's it. I think all of us are tired, and I'm looking for the next beer, but I have time for a few questions.
Okay, please, пожалуйста, несколько вопросов можно задать. И мы успешно перейдем пить кофе и чай. No questions? Okay.
Here's a question.
The token moment.
Yeah.
Let me say there are also higher patronates considering the time. So if you are interested in this, then you can go to the theory. There are already definitions. But the normal patronate is saying nothing about the time. And so I was a student in Bonn, and one of the pupils of Petri was professor in Bonn and used the chance to include the patronates in the standard lectures. And he always said, you know, to play with the time is dangerous. And I think this was the reason that Petri never brought the time into the transitions. It was not Petri. Other guys did it. But so it is possible. If you are interested in time, you will find a lot of theorems and definitions, and a lot of guys did it already. It's clear. Finally, you need the time. Yeah.
Yes, so what I already said, if
very fast, I am able to solve some problems about those some pathways,
so let me say the following. We use your Advisio tool. And you know, if you use your tool, huge networks will show up. And then we are using the cell illustrator. Then we tried to transfer such a huge network directly to the cell illustrator. And then we recognized it's not possible. The cell illustrator is not able to let me say, to come up with filter nets with 1,000 nodes. And we asked Matsuno, what is the reason? No answer, but this is what we saw. The other answer, I gave the answer already. If you are interested in all possible reactions, it's exponential the time. And if your network is in 1,000, you can forget it. If you have small networks, it's possible. Perhaps that's the reason that the cell illustrator does not allow huge networks. I don't know. But normally, if you have a network, let it run, and you saw this simple linear algebra, that's not a problem, let it run. So go from one configuration to the next configuration. But if you would like to see all possible reactions, this is, I said it, not only for the patron, it's a problem. It doesn't matter which model you will use. Because years ago I worked with rule-based systems, it's the same. And also object-oriented, it's the same. It's, if you would like to see every reaction, possible reaction, it's not possible. We have complex, exponential complexity and more. So we have to reduce it. And perhaps this is also an advantage of the patriots. What I said, you can place a patriot inside a transition, so you can come up with a hierarchy. So I'm a fan of the patriots. I forgot all what I did with the rules. I think it's the best tool. But however, the students, perhaps you have an idea, and you will come up with a better formalism. It's still open. It's still the main question of bioinformatics. Which model is useful finally to implement a virtual cell? This is still open. I think it's still open. Thanks.
Okay. I think that we should go to the space, and we have, I think, 20 minutes to have a coffee. Then people who are going to the seminar, registered people, then should collect, and I will follow you to the another building for the seminar. Okay. 20 минут, пожалуйста. Там сейчас все подготовлено. Можете
кушать. I didn't understand. In the Petrinets, well, there are, let's say, the transitions elementary, yes? Mm-hmm. One another. Are they executed in the modeling process consequently or
all at a time?
Suppose you have your laces with two transitions.
The amount of mark transferred
here depends on how much is here and how much does this thing transition to... So how do you deal with causality? Because it's circular. It depends on this and at the same time...
But you will take a look to this transition. This transition can fire... If the precondition is satisfied, you can fire.
And suppose all preconditions for this and for this are satisfied. How do you determine who is the first?
Yeah, this is what I said. The time is playing no role. So let me
say... But you have different results.
Let me say the following. If we are discussing this here on the paper, we will say time is open. T1 and T2 can fire. Make a token here also. Mm-hmm. If you make one token here to this, so T1 and T2 two can fire.
Mm-hmm.
So and then I said, then we have to think about the potential set of T1 and T2. That means both are not firing. T1 is firing, T2 is firing,
so
and both...
Actually, we have a trio of probable situations, and we have to see through all of them to understand the whole situation.
Exactly. But this is expensive. This is what I said. If you think about the potential set, then you will come up with such a tree. And this tree is...
Are these situations... do the situation tend to recur? Do they cyclize? I'm asking if this tree expands exponentially, infinitely, or does
okay,
it
here,
return to...
Here, and, okay, here you have a special situation, because it's always the same state, the same configuration.
This is a simple example.
Yeah, this is a simple example. Here it is going around permanently.
And but it's not accessory, it can expand forever.
Yeah. Here you have a simple example. And you're...
As you already told that there's a use of differential equations in the metabolic pathways.
Mm-hmm.
Can you suggest me some references for that?
Yeah. So there are papers already trying to show, patented papers trying to show. I have it not in my mind.
Okay.
Schuster, I can say Stefan Schuster. Take a look to Stefan in the internet. Stefan Schuster. Schuster University Jena. He published things. Jena. So he published exactly. He combined because Stefan Schuster is famous. He is a famous guy using differential equations. He is theoretical biology. So Schuster, Heinrich, he just died 1 year ago. Heinrich from Humboldt University. But this Stefan Schuster published exactly the paper, how can we combine Petri nets and differential equations, exactly.
Yeah.
I can give you a card.